Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center, located in Mountain View, California.
Well, thank you. Connecting with Les or thinking about Les. He and I are both Yankee fans from New York, and it's a very heartfelt connection. Reading the, I had never read the whole Loving Kindness Sutra. And what's interesting, and sitting here with a half hour with you meditating, is so much of what we try to do when we teach forgiveness is to get people, even for a second, to calm down and center. The emotional disturbance that we all create when we're hurt, injured, violated, injustice, takes us so far from our center. And it is unbelievably challenging to ask people to come back. And just the other day, I have run the Stanford Forgiveness Project now for about 20 years. And we've gone to different places in the world, and we've dealt with just the most horrendous things that people do to each other, and some things not so horrendous where people are all bent out of shape. But the other day, I had a phone interview, and I was interviewed by the national news in Toronto. Because there was an accident last year in Saskatchewan where a very new truck driver, untrained and not fully whatever, went through a red light and plowed into a school bus and killed 16 hockey players and injured the rest. And the inquest is taking place now, and the victim statements are being read. And I think there are a dozen people who survived the crash, and they're listening to the parents and the remaining people, and some of them stood up and said, enough pain, enough suffering. I don't want anybody else to suffer ever after what I've been through. So, of course, I forgive this guy. And others were, I'd like to get there, but I'm not there yet. And still others are, I'm not even sure I'd like to get there. And still others are, nothing could punish them enough for what they did to me. And it's very interesting because they're asking for my comments on the radio or on the news, and having experienced these kind of questions now for 20 years, whether it's the murders in Charleston or the Amish community, or I just got back from the country of Colombia where they're trying to recover from a civil war. Only a few of us have our hearts open enough to really do something like that. And it's amazing to try to see and listen to and figure out what is it that allows those handful to be so open-hearted and kind, and what is it that allows most of us to be okay with our judgments and hostilities. Now, I don't have a great answer. I just have listened to so much and have seen the triumph of goodwill and, this, where let no one deceive another, nor despise any being, let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. And I've spent decades now, even in the smallest ways, trying to get people to act a little more like that. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. I teach at Stanford. I have done so for 25 years. 2 months after Donald Trump won the election a couple of years ago, I asked one class of students, how many of you are still upset about the election? It was probably February. And 35 out of 36 people raised their hand because they were still upset about the election. And these are nice kids. But every one of them had anger and wished harm upon a Republican president. Every one of them. And it was interesting to me to see, like, very bright people, well-raised mostly, in one of the best institutions of the world. But the political bias of that institution and the people there is so intense that there was no recognition that a lot of their speech was hate speech. Because everybody agrees with it. And I think to myself, like, what is this? Like, what is it about us that this, the opposite of this, goes so deep and is so reflexive and is so reflected in our tribal alliances that we don't recognize that at the other end of that speech or that bad will is a human being? Like, I struggle with this. I mean, I struggle with it on my own vibe, but more culturally, where I see it just everywhere. Like, let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. I mean, that's the essence of forgiveness. Like, that there's no reason that I can't work through my woundedness so that I don't have to, by anger or hatred, wish harm to anyone. That's forgiveness. That I don't have to, and I don't want to, and I choose not to. But it's so hard. I remember once doing a series of classes for a religious science church. I just did the forgiveness class, and the minister there flew me down from here to a nice church in Southern California, and she had like a 6-part series of spiritual practices, and one of them was like generosity, and one of them was abundance, and one of them was loving kindness, and one of them is equanimity. And she got like 80 people, and one of them was forgiveness, and she got 4. Because forgiveness doesn't offer us our accumulative self anything. We don't get bigger or stronger or puffier or anything. We let go of that little piece of the ego that was holding on to something and obstructing something else. And we let it go even when the world was unkind to us. And it's amazingly hard to do. I've even noticed I'm a founding advisor to the Greater Good Center in Berkeley, a wonderful center that studies the science of positiveness and goodness. And forgiveness has come from being up at the top now to way down at the bottom, because it's so much harder than mindfulness and self-compassion, all self. But forgiveness is, wait a second, the self is the obstacle. That's why forgiveness is so hard and so unwanted. Because you have to recognize that this construct of who I am, that's what was hurt. And then forgiveness asks you to let go of that hurt and let go of that identification. And boy, like, who wants that? And because of that, I wish it wasn't so true and so sad. Because we don't forgive, each of us carries around some little reasons why we can be unkind. Like, we hold on to these. These are our little Fort Knox of why it is that we don't have to be kind, why it is that if we're married, we don't have to be kind to our partner, because we can remind themselves of the times that they weren't kind to us, so we get a pass. Or why it is that we don't have to be kind to the political party that we don't like. Or why it is we don't have to be kind to a boss that fired us. We use it. The unforgiveness is our ballast for the ego holding on to its negativity. It's its justification for why we don't just have to be, let none by anger or greed wish harm to another, because we all immediately come up with our reasons. I can't be kind to them. I can't do this. Remember this. Remember what happened to my family. Remember what happened to my tribe. Remember what happened 2 years ago or 5 years ago. Remember. It's not, I'm going to tell you, one of the reasons why there ain't that many people doing what I do is it ain't that much fun. Because people give this stuff up so unwillingly. This justification for why, one, they're not happy, or two, why they can't lead the way in goodwill. You know, why? We all have our reasons. We all keep them. We all store them, and we all replay them to ourselves. We all do. And yet, what I have seen is some of the people who, when tragedy strikes, forgive. Because in the business of forgiveness, they've done what's called pre-forgiveness. So I've heard it more with Christians, I mean, because that's just what gets on the news. But there's a group of Christians who take the Christ's words, forgive them, they know not what they do. Or how many times do I have to forgive if I'm offended? Seven. And then Jesus says, no, seven times 70. Or obviously in your Buddhist tradition, let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. Some people take that to heart. And they let it work in them so that they have a form called pre-forgiveness. They're primed. They practice. They're ready when something awful happens. But it's not common. And it's, I mean, again, I just got back from, we're doing a forgiveness project in Colombia. And they're just ending, or have ended, a 50-year civil war. And they're trying to, you know, spread some goodwill. And so they invited us to help them create an exhibit at one of their national museums about forgiveness. And then they're going to take that exhibit all around the country. And they've hired some young people to teach forgiveness as they go around to students and corporate sites. So they're trying. And yet, I could tell you that when I was in the big auditorium giving a talk, I didn't feel totally safe. Like there's still that undercurrent of not just that I've been harmed, because that's vulnerability, but I've been harmed and the world needs to watch out. That I've been harmed and I'm not going to take that in a certain way anymore. You know, I remember much closer to home how many talks I've given, like, to divorce support groups, which, if any way, is kind of nastier than Columbia. We don't practice saying, I forgive you. May you be okay. You know, the loving kindness prayer looks like a really nice thing. You know, may all beings be happy. May they be joyous and live in safety. And that includes my ex-husband. All living beings, including my ex-husband, whether weak or strong, in high, middle, or ex-husband realms of existence. Yeah. Somehow, we got to bring this stuff in and have it operate on our nervous system and almost infiltrate our DNA. Because from everything I understand, our basic wiring is to be pretty harsh and pretty anxious and pretty threat-centered. And it's not easy to break that. So when I started talking to you 15 minutes ago, what I said is we try with people to at least get them at the beginning to center. You just had 45 minutes or more of that practice of center. And then what we try to get people to do is have them listen to their center. Because if you're really in touch with your center doesn't want anybody to suffer. Because that center, I believe, is shared with everybody. There's one center of some kind. But if you get in touch with your center, there's no part there that wants anybody else to suffer. And what we understood when we developed the Forgiveness Project was we don't want to talk anybody out of anything. And we don't want to argue with them, and we don't. And we don't want to suggest to them that the suffering isn't real or the people didn't really mean it, because oftentimes the people really meant it. But what we wanted them to do is get in touch with the part of themselves that couldn't imagine wanting anybody else to suffer. So inside of them, they lose the desire for revenge and punishment, because they get in touch with the healed part of themselves, not the wounded part of themselves. And then they learn to listen to the healed part of themselves, which isn't that hard when you recognize it's always there. You know, there's a part of each of us that speaks to us, tells us almost universally to be kind, and is invariable in that advice. It has different words for it. Sometimes the advice is to be kind to yourself. Sometimes it's to be kind to other people. But it's always, even if you feel as justified as can be in being contemptuous, that little voice is always there going, are you sure? Are you sure this is the best way to behave? Are you positive? Remember. But when we're adrenalized, or when we're self-righteous, or when we're fearful, That little voice gets about micro dot. Well, what we discovered or try to teach people is make that little voice louder. Like, it has nothing to do with telling somebody that, no, you're wrong. Your father really meant to be a nice dad, even though he wasn't, or have pity on your dad or empathy. We don't do that at all because it happens not to work very well. But what we do try to remind people is that as much as the world may have been difficult and harmful, it's also exquisitely beautiful. And as much as people have been insensitive to you, many of them have been stunningly kind. You decide what you pay attention to, and you decide what happens because of where you put your attention. So let me give you just a simple practice, just while you're sitting there, and you should be reasonably still centered. I've only been talking for a few minutes. Just while you're there, ask yourself, like in the last 36 hours, who's been kind to me? Like, direct your mind to review the last 36 hours only for the purpose of investigating who's been kind. The minute you even ask that question, you know, your blood pressure goes down, your shoulders get a little less tight, even if you've just meditated, and your body, like, relaxes a little bit. But if you really investigate that question, like, what does kindness mean? And how broadly and deeply can I define it? Is kindness opening a door for me? Cooperating with me at work? Helping raise my kids? Pumping gas? What's kindness? We are so unskillful and deficient in this kind of exploration that even improving this a little bit makes you more forgiving. Just naturally, by bringing a little more accuracy and truth-telling into your life about what kind of life you have. But if you really ask yourself, who's been kind? And you take a moment to hold an image of your day, it's striking. You know, a friend who met you for lunch. Anybody who listened to you. Shared a chore. Doesn't matter. Took out the garbage. The shift from who has been unkind to me, which is at the heart of our default thinking of the world, to who has been kind to me, scares most of us. Because it's such a different view. And it means you know how much of your drama you would have to give up if that shift was for real. Like, it would be a game changer for the personality we've all constructed, which is, research shows, spend somewhere between 75 and 80% of its day complaining. Like, that's what the average middle-class American, that's the distribution in their being. It's about 75 to 80% complaining. And these are people who have three squares a day. But we would have so much change that we couldn't handle it. Like, one of the meditation like the schlocky meditation teachers that I like, the more, you know, consumer-oriented, not deep traditions like this, has talked about, at best, most of us can get about 10% happier, which is fantastic. But you can't aim at 50 because your being can't take it. Like, you wouldn't know what to do because we're wired grouches. And what do they say? That the evolutionary joke is like, we're all the descendants of anxious apes. Like the chill apes, they're gone. You know, sir, you know what I mean? Like the mellow apes who shared their bananas and were happy to let anybody climb their tree, they didn't become us. It's the anxious apes that became us. And so we have so much biology and genetics in there. And so if we just changed a little bit towards, like, what's good and what works and who's been kind to me and how much unbelievable beauty there is in this world, we'd forgive more. Like, because our little accounting system would change. Because we pay so little attention to what's good, the things that weren't so good, they have much more weight on the asset deficit balance sheet. Oh, remember when you said this 18 years ago? Because we don't remember. I went to, I think, my 30th high school reunion, the only one that I could tolerate. And a guy came up to me. Yeah, it was what, 48 years old. A guy came up to me and said, I've never forgiven you for what you did in 11th grade. I had barely knew who he was, but 11th grade? He even told me I didn't remember. But he remembered. We're wired to remember. That's why these things are necessary, is to teach us to catalyze different wiring, to teach us to use, I mean, colloquially, different pathways in your brain and nervous system to give us words for kindness, you know, to give us phrases and language and almost determination to not be so blaming. You know, one of the challenges for me was, having done this for so long and seen so many ways that people are harsh, and then seen so many justifications for it, that it's quite something. The ingenuity with which we all hold on to our harshness. So I'll tell somebody or talk to them about forgiveness. And it just happened the other day with friends. I was suggesting that her harshness towards somebody who disagreed with her politically was probably not in keeping with her spiritual tradition. That's something, although I was kidding her, but, you know, like, she's had a 40-year yoga practice, and yet she was hostile and demeaning towards somebody whose politics disagreed with her. And I said, that's probably not what the teachers are aiming at. No, we've known each other a long time. And she said, well, would you be telling me that about Adolf Hitler? That's what our mind does to hold on. That's how desperately we don't want to let go of this stuff. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked about Adolf Hitler in some ways when I've asked people to forgive their husband. What, would you forgive Adolf Hitler? I don't know. I was never married to him. He's dead now, so I can't try it out, you know? But we have an opportunity with practice to slowly transform ourselves into nicer people. Because I have to believe that's the point. For me, I can't believe that it's just personal anything. That I just can't believe, that the whole point of this is just personal liberation or something. It has to be for the whole. And all of this, it's to reorient us to goodwill and try to take away the multi-dimensional, multifarious ways that we tell ourselves our harshness and unkindness make sense. I've even had people, I was in a Christian retreat center once, and I was talking about forgiveness to probably three times as many people as are in here. It was a beautiful chapel. And I'm going on for about 10 minutes, maybe, and a couple of women jump up and basically say, "That's great, but you never met my ex-husband. Because had you, you'd stop teaching." And this is what I told them. I mean, I'm a New Yorker, so there's an edge. No, I looked at them, I swear, and I said, "Look, you see that guy there, Jesus? You know, the guy hanging there with the cross and the thorns? He's your guy. I'm Jewish. He's not my guy. Take the program." His whole message is forgive, including your ex-husband, including your mother, including everybody. And the resistance is so profound. So I'm going to take 10 more minutes, I know, before I'm done. Let me just give you a couple simple practices, because the things that you can work on easiest are practicing the opposite of complaint speech. Because when you're so in the habit of complaining, it's very easy when you've been wounded or mistreated to simply process that through the pattern of complaint. So we just teach people at the very beginning the simplest practices of not complaint. So I'm going to ask you to do a couple. The first is, think of one person in this world besides yourself that you could say nice things about. I'm serious. Think of one person that you could say nice things about without being embarrassed or whatever. And then what I want you to do is turn to somebody next to you, and both of you say nice things about one person in your life and do not complain at all. So you can't say, "My neighbor's great, except," which is what we do. Or, "My partner's great, except this morning they forgot to take out the garbage." And then your mind goes, "Well, three times last week they didn't take out garbage. Maybe they're not so great." Because this is the mind that we're taming with our practice. So I'd like you to find somebody, have like a 2-3 minute conversation, which will feel like root canal, because we're so not used to doing this. Of just talk about the things you respect, appreciate, love, honor, cherish, model, want to pay forward, about some good soul in your life. Find a partner and I'll call you back shortly. Thank you. You know, one of the And I'm going to give you one more practice like that before I'm done. But one of the really challenging things, and one of the interesting findings from like marital therapy or marital world, it's like the, may all beings be happy. We don't practice this because we need help in wishing the people we like to be happy. We practice this to help us wish the people we don't like to be happy. It's easy to wish well the people who do what you want. It's hard to wish well people who don't. You know, one of the key findings of couples therapy and one of the key advice points to come out of it is what you're doing when you couple with somebody long term is you're choosing which set of problems you want to handle. No, but that's the truth. You're choosing whose crap you're willing to tolerate. And they found this out through like pretty rigorous experimentation that most people like, I mean, I'll just be me, most people like my good qualities. So it doesn't take an intimate relationship to tolerate those. The intimate relationship and the depth and breadth of it is because we make a commitment to each other to tolerate their difficult qualities. Anybody can tolerate their good qualities. Anybody can enjoy those. And one of the key pieces of understanding from really good couple stuff is that really you want to select the downside that you can deal with because the upside's going to be fine. But the downside, you have to recognize that, wow, I'm signing on for difficulty. I may not like this difficulty. I may want a slob rather than a, you know, something else. But this is the forgiveness question with this whole thing. You know, that none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. Nobody is angry if somebody gives them money. Well, that's not true. There are weird people who get angry over anything. But on the whole, most people do not get angry when you give them stuff. But many people get angry when you take stuff from them. So this sutra is to remind us how to behave when people take stuff, when they don't do what they want, when they're unkind, when they're selfish, when they're ugly. Because we don't need this to remind us that if somebody walks up to you and tells you you're wonderful and can they do anything for you and they bow and hand you tea or whatever it is, you're generally not going to have negative feelings towards them. So you don't need the sutra. But we need it when people trigger us, when they don't do what we want, when our partner shows up their ugly side. That's when we need all the help we can get. What I have seen, this is just besides my personal, like, long-term meditation practice, is meditation's not enough. It takes deep introspection, a willingness to see your own flaws, and that's almost harder than the meditation part, is to look at yourself. But it takes, like, an in-the-world practice of something like this. You know, may I teach myself to behave differently? There are many opportunities to do that. Gratitude is a good one. May I teach myself to see the good and praise it? May I teach myself to be compassionate? May I teach myself to be forgiving? But meditation alone, I don't see it, and I don't think the research supports that is sufficient to transform us. It's necessary, I just don't see it as sufficient. So we're in this world with all of us crazy people, and we have to figure out how to get along with each other. The other thing is, one of the findings coming out from long-term successful marriage and partnership is that you can't do it without healthy doses of forgiveness. It's unexpected that that's like in the top five of things that predict a successful long-term relationship: forgiveness. At the worst, we're hostile. But at our best, we're scared, we're vulnerable, we're unskillful, we're self-absorbed, we're all sorts of things. And we bump into each other all the time with those qualities. So this is a good place to practice, you know, wish no harm to another. It for me, having been through many different religious and spiritual traditions, you know, they have the same thing at their center. You know, be kind. Anyway, let me finish with a 2-minute practice of a kind of secularized Ho'oponopono from the Hawaiian tradition. And this is very secularized and processed through my own nuttiness. But I do go to Hawaii regularly to do work, and I have met with real Ho'oponopono practitioners. And please, I'm not doing that. I don't even understand that. But this is a good approximation, okay? So what I want you to do first is, while you're sitting there, just ask yourself, what's one way that I have harmed somebody who I care for recently? And it could be commission or omission. The simplest, you don't have to think of like you took an axe to them. The simplest is, they called me up. I was in the middle of checking my phone for the 400th time, and I was burnt out and restless. I didn't speak to them, but they were sad and needed a ear. So I rejected them due to selfishness. It's not a crime. But I want you to pick one thing in like the last 2 weeks where you hurt somebody close to you. Not necessarily intentionally. But I want you to picture it. And I'd like you, if possible, to feel just right here a little ouch. You know, just a little ouch. And then the Ho'oponopono practice is, we're going to say out loud, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, and thank you. Okay? So I'll say it first, you repeat it after me. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. We'll do more, but the thank you is central to the Hawaiian understanding, because what they maintain in this Ho'oponopono reconciliation practice is an omnipresent sense of thank you for the relationship. And that's key. You're here. We're in relationship. Thank you. Okay. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. You whisper it now when I say it out loud. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. You say it silently, no vocalization after I say it. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. And now the last thing is, I want you to bring your attention to the area around your heart. And I want you to feel those words there. No vocalization, but right here. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And thank you. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And thank you. And then just sit for 5 or 10 seconds and just feel those words. I love you. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And thank you. And I thank you for your time. I thank you for inviting me into your meditation group. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.